Welcome to Medicus, a student-run podcast about any and all things in the world of medicine. Follow along as we interview outstanding individuals about important topics in healthcare. Hey guys, and welcome back to Medicus. I'm Rasa, and in this new mini-series, we talk to individuals who took a detour in medical school and did not stick to the traditional four-year curriculum. Today, we have Nick Sasso, who is a fourth-year medical student at Loyola Stritch School of Medicine, joining us to share his experience. Hey, Nick. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Rasa. Thanks for having me.
So can you introduce yourself to our listeners, touching on your education and decision to pursue medicine and any future career aspirations?
For sure. And I think this could be like a good kind of topic in general for pre-med listeners, because I had a very atypical course to get to medical school. So I'm a first-generation American. My parents immigrated from Chile. I grew up in New York and, like, from the get-go, loved science. I went to Colgate University in upstate New York, and that's where I majored in neuroscience. So that was already kind of the formation of, like, my love of the brain. After I graduated in 2011, I joined Teach for America, and I was a teacher for half a decade. I was stationed in Chicago, so 2011 is when I moved to Chicago and it became my new home. I got a master's in teaching. I was, you know, very much in education. I loved it. But the dream was always medicine. And in my mind, I see medicine as another form of teaching. There's just so much teaching that occurs, be it with your classmates or, you know, residents around you and certainly your patients. Medicine and teaching have always gone hand in hand for me. So I did a post-bac program at Dominican University here just outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I got a second bachelor's in medical science. And that was kind of like the launch pad to apply to medical school. And I was accepted at Stritch in 2018. And that's when I started medical school. Where do I see myself headed? Neurology is what I'm applying to this year. And some foreshadowing here, I'm very interested in autonomic disorders, but also interventional neurology is really cool. I'm a bit of a junkie for the operating room. So that's kind of what I've got going on.
Yeah, very cool. And definitely you'll have some time during your residency, I think, to explore those options. Mm-hmm. Again, you were foreshadowing maybe a little bit, but can you tell us about your medical school detour?
So my detour was a result of chronic illness, because of what I now know to be postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, as well as myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome, MECFS.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah, it's a lot of words. It's a lot of letters. So I'll call them POTS and MECFS. And it's a very interesting path in terms of how symptoms unfolded, how it was ultimately diagnosed, and how it affected and still affects, you know, my entire life, but also like course through medical school. To kind of walk through it, because I think it's an interesting story, symptoms kind of began to show up around like 2014. Mm-hmm. By 2016, there was a running joke that I was just like always tachycardic. All right, I could be sitting down, I'm burning fat, my heart rate's at 160, you know. It was just like, so like early on, like I was picking up on things that, you know, my body is not exactly normal, but it wasn't, clearly didn't rise to the level of like, huh, this requires medical attention.
Sure.
I started Stritch in 2018. We were in the same class starting off. And that's when things kind of like took a turn. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what triggered it, but all my symptoms really, they became more frequent and far more severe. So to kind of like walk through them, because it was just, it's very interesting how variable and severe the symptoms can be.
Sure.
So by my M1 year, I mean, things were crazy. So to kind of like go through the symptoms, pain was a very big component of it. The pain, actually, I remember the day it began, because it was the day I got accepted to Stritch. And that day, I remember, my right hand started hurting like never before, all the joints, and it kind of developed to just generalized myalgias, arthralgias, predominantly affecting my hands and my lower extremities. I've played guitar since I was a kid. It got to the point where, you know, the pain and the dexterity were so compromised that I couldn't play guitar anymore. It was difficult to hold a pencil. And just, it's obviously very difficult to kind of go through your day feeling in constant pain. Yeah. There was debilitating fatigue. And sure, we all get tired, but we're talking about, you know, fatigue that you can sleep and no amount of sleep is refreshing mm-hmm. for you. It impacts your day to day to the point where I was carrying around a pillow and a blanket
wow.
during M1 year because I just had to take naps. I could not physically make it through the yeah. day. It would just be a debilitating amount of fatigue. And, you know, if you ever get so tired, you're trying to pull an all-nighter and things get fuzzy, you know, your brain isn't working as yeah. well as it should. It would feel like that for me within a span of a few hours. There was an associated cognitive fog, mm-hmm. so it felt like all executive functions were kind of altered. It was hard to study. Yeah. It was hard to be a medical student, right? An extremely academically demanding challenge. Attention was difficult. It was a struggle. It was a struggle to study just when I was awake. Those like few precious hours that I had, they were difficult. Mm-hmm. A lot of weird sensory things. It was difficult. It felt to regulate my body temperature. I'd be extremely hot to the point where I just wanted to rip off all my clothes. And the very next moment, I was just freezing my butt off. I needed as many layers as I could find. There were times where I would all of a sudden feel febrile and I would like obsessively take my temperature. Totally okay. It would feel sometimes like I just like had the flu out of nowhere. Kind of just like whole body, kind of weird sensation, yeah. but there's no cough, there's no temperature, but you feel sick. A lot of chest discomfort. Mm-hmm. And I try to be careful with the word pain, because especially in medicine, when you say chest pain, you kind of like, what's going on? And I actually remember this, I don't know if you remember this, but during our M1 year, it was right before we were going into like a host defense lecture. And you and I were outside of the room. And I was having one of these episodes.
I do actually remember this.
Me.
I do, yeah. yes.
You're like, are you okay? I'm like, oh, my chest's hurting. You're like, do you need to go to the emergency room? And I'm like, nah, this happens all the time.
I know. And it's so wild, you know, all of these symptoms that you list that were happening. I mean, you hit it really well. When I heard about your diagnosis later on, it was shocking to me how much you were able to accomplish living such a debilitating life at that point. So it was amazing to me that you continued, you know, going to lecture and doing your best, because I don't know if I could have.
I mean, it came at a price, yeah. you know, and I'll get to the burnout and the depression and the anxiety that's associated with just being chronically right. ill, but then especially during medical school, you know, but it's so interesting to hear that the perspective from someone else. Yeah. I mean, like I tried really, really mm-hmm. hard to perhaps like stubbornly so, to yeah. just continue to work through it, which I think is a pretty perhaps typical attitude of your, you know, prototypical medical student.
Right. And I think it's one of those diagnoses. It's not very external, right? So you can't necessarily pinpoint, mm-hmm. people yeah. can't see it. So it's something that from the perspective of an outsider looking in, it's like, Nick's fine. You know, unless totally. You say something, it would be really hard for someone to think that you're living with a condition that really compromises your day to day.
For sure. You know, and terms like invisible illnesses have been used in association with POTS and, you know, similar conditions. Cause like totally to your point. Yeah. Like just at quick glance, like this does not look like an individual who's sick. Right. And then you kind of find out exactly what's going on. And it can be pretty wild to kind of like fast forward just a little bit where, you know, the diagnosis finally kind of came through. It was now in my M2 year. And by this point, in addition to all those symptoms, it felt like every body system was affected. Mm-hmm. I had GI issues, respiratory issues, like nothing was working.
Oh my gosh.
And it's obviously very difficult to try to be a medical student while all those things are occurring. And being ill just exacerbates depression, anxiety. The burnout by the end of it was so real. I had worked myself into the ground trying to stay afloat, trying to continue. I hate to say that. I feel like when it finally did get to the point where I needed to take a medical leave, it was less me making the decision and more like my body had reached a point where the decision was made yeah. for me. There was no way to continue. And that point occurred right before second semester of M2 mm-hmm. year, where at this point now the orthostatic symptoms were very pronounced. So I was having multiple, up to like 30 episodes a day of mostly pre-syncope, mm-hmm. at times full syncope, wow. just like totally losing consciousness. I'd end up on the floor randomly. Most of the time, again, with the pre-syncope, it was just like I'd lose muscle tone. I'd end up on the ground, eyes closed, everything dark. I was kind of aware of what was going on around me, but I was out of it. And obviously very scary at the time for my partner, my girlfriend at the time, who's not my wife.
Congratulations.
Thank you. To kind of experience that. You know, do I call an ambulance? Like, what do I do? So that was kind of the crescendo of all the symptoms. And it was actually during one of these episodes that my wife decided to call my psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. So now, at the time, she was a Loyola psychiatrist. She's in private practice now. And I gave her immense credit for just the caliber of physician that she is. She was very attuned and determined to figure out what was going on with me outside from just the depression and anxiety mm-hmm. that I was having. You know, she was a psychiatrist that ordered blood work. She's looking at inflammatory markers. She's ordering an EKG, sleep studies, things that really, like, in my mind at least, broke the mold of what a psychiatrist yeah. is and like kind of what they do. And it was during this one, like, really bad episode where I'm on the ground. My now wife calls her up and my psychiatrist was like, what's his heart rate right now? And my wife takes my pulse, says it's 80. And in my haze, I'm like, oh, that's not right. I'm tachycardic all the time. And I think the combination of me being on the ground, not believing that my heart rate could be 80, was the final piece of the puzzle for my doctor. And she was like, Nick, I think you might have POTS.
Oh, wow.
So we did further workup after that point. We explored it. And lo and behold, she nailed it. It was POTS. So I'm going to tear up a little here. She's such a great doctor, you know? Mm-hmm. In the literature, you'll see how POTS and similar conditions are very frequently misdiagnosed and underdiagnosed. The average time to diagnosis can be upwards of 6 to 7 years. And I totally see that in my story as well. You know, there were so many times where I went to different physicians. They picked up on the symptoms, but they never nailed the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know, was it because they were unaware of POTS and dysautonomia, or was it just because they just didn't put the pieces together? So I give so much credit to my psychiatrist because she did an astounding, very emotional right now.
I mean, she changed your life, you know, providing you for with real. Answers.
Yeah. And she still provides amazing care. But yeah, I mean, literally life-changing, nailing the diagnosis, figuring out what was wrong, and then how to begin to intervene, to now we're at a point where I can continue with my life and have symptoms managed. So a lot of credit to her.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I think just quick little thing for all our medical students and pre-med people listening, never underestimate the power of a good patient history. Mm-hmm. I think the reason she nailed the diagnosis is because she was tireless in her effort to collect data, mm-hmm. not just the historical data of what's happening to me on the day to day, but again, the lab testing and, you know, ancillary studies. She took a great history, physical, looked at all the labs and she was able to figure it out. Never underestimate the power of a good history.
No kidding. So, you walked us through your journey and your symptoms and experiences, but can you just give kind of a quick summary? I don't know, not Wikipedia, but, you know, up-to-date summary of these syndromes.
Yeah. So here's where things get really interesting academically mm-hmm. for me, because like essentially what we're talking about is like some neurologic dysfunction that's involved, yeah. right? So here's the budding neurologist now afflicted with
nerding out, yeah.
POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. I hate the name. I'll explain why. It does a really good job at describing a single phenomenon and not so much kind of everything else that's involved with the experience of someone who has POTS. Mm-hmm. So let's look at what is normal physiology for an individual who stands up upwards of, you know, 500 to 800 cc's of blood is displaced downward into your abdomen, into your lower mm-hmm. extremities. That means there's less volume and thus less blood pressure. The aortic arch, the carotid sinus, your baroreceptors pick that up. They send impulses via the vagus and hypoglossal nerve. Love the neurology, right?
Love it.
And your body responds with an autonomic response. Predominantly, the sympathetic response is to constrict the vasculature and assist in bringing that blood back up against gravity. There's a parasympathetic response that allows for the heart to be more overcome by the sympathetic kind of inputs and thus, you know, increase contractility and so forth. The point is that it helps bring that blood volume back upwards, and in a instant, this reflex occurs and your body's able to maintain homeostasis. So that's kind of the normal physiology of what is supposed to happen when you stand up. In an individual with POTS, for reasons not totally understood, that doesn't happen. Something goes awry. You stand up and there is a dysfunctional autonomic response in which there isn't that correction. Ultimately, you end up with reflex tachycardia, in the sense that your heart just becomes instantly tachycardic, trying to respond to you just standing up. And it's important to note that this is not orthostatic hypotension. There is no drop in blood pressure. And I could do this right now. I'm sitting currently. If I were to stand up, my heart rate would instantaneously jump, you know, some 30, 40 beats, perhaps a little less because I'm currently medicated. But in kind of like the height of symptoms, these minor changes in position would cause really drastic changes in heart rate, which is, again, all neurally mediated. It's an autonomic response. So why does POTS occur? We don't fully understand. There's evidence to suggest that this dysfunction, this one phenomenon, is associated with things like a hypovolemic state, just being kind of baseline low blood pressure. It's associated with cardiovascular deconditioning. It's associated in some cases with neuroendocrine dysfunction. So hyperadrenergic states, some individuals have excess catecholamines, norepinephrine in their bodies. Some individuals have been found to have dysfunction in their renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And some case reports point to autoimmunity, autoantibodies against acetylcholine receptors, although that I've read those papers and they're not very convincing. Very small sample sizes. That's kind of way at the bottom of my list. In terms of ME/CFS, kind of very similar in terms of there's studies that show immune dysfunction, neuroendocrine dysfunction, metabolic dysfunction at times at the level of the mitochondria in these individuals. But specifically with ME/CFS, one very well-studied area is the association between viruses and the onset of ME/CFS, and in particular, Epstein-Barr virus. It is not identified as the cause of these syndromes, but it certainly correlates and is very frequently cited as an inciting event. You know, so once we figured all this out, that this is what's happening with me, and I began to do the research and started diving into the literature myself, and I'm starting to put things together, I reflect a little and I'm like, you know, back in like 2012, 2013, I had Epstein-Barr. I had mono really, really badly. And I can't help but wonder now if perhaps that could have been the inciting event. So one thing that we can kind of ask ourselves is, like, could it be that in a genetically predisposed individual, some of these viruses can be the precipitating event for ensuing immune and neurologic, specifically like autonomic dysfunction that culminates in these ultimate symptoms of fatigue, myalgia, autonomic dysfunction in terms of having POTS. And what's super interesting is, you know, Epstein-Barr is a great candidate because once you get it, you have it for life. It persists. It frequently reactivates. So it's like a good candidate for a possible chronic infectious agent. But now what is very interesting is that we are seeing a lot of autonomic dysfunction, a lot of ME/CFS, and even POTS in individuals who had COVID and are now described as having long COVID. I do a lot of work in Loyola's long COVID clinic, led by Dr. Biller, brilliant neurologist. And we see together a lot of patients who come in with very similar stories of cognitive fog, of debilitating fatigue. Some individuals do meet the criteria for POTS. So we're seeing cardiovascular autonomic dysfunction. And I think it's a very valid question to ask, you know, what is the association between certain viral infections and consequences on the central nervous system, the peripheral nervous system, subsequent immune dysfunction, and so forth. So my personal hypothesis slash what I wonder is, yeah, could all of this, at least with me, could this all have been as a result of an initial viral infection? So hence why, in terms of the future career aspirations, I'm really interested in that intersection between viruses and neurology. So I think there's a lot going on there that we don't fully understand. And, you know, there's a lot of room to grow there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've seen so many studies recently coming out looking at, you know, linking viruses to things like MS, to even Alzheimer's disease, right? So I think there is a lot to explore then, especially like we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic. I think that will really allow us to really understand this better, just because we had such a massive N, right? Such a significant amount of people got infected. We know a very clear timeline, a point that this happened. It wasn't like, oh, you know, this could have happened 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We know when the pandemic began and people started getting sick. So I think it will be interesting to see where the research takes us in the next decade or so.
You nailed it. My diagnosis, my experiences came right before the pandemic hit, you know, like 2019, essentially. And at the time, the attitudes around POTS, around autonomic dysfunction, and even things like chronic fatigue, I would describe some of them as very backwards. And certainly, I think while there's so much rich literature, it hasn't translated to the clinical side of medicine. And then, yeah, to your point, this pandemic occurs. We have a huge amount of people that are suffering from long COVID with symptoms very similar or are being straight up diagnosed with ME/CFS and POTS. And it has created a huge need, but also a huge body of evidence that we can work on. And yeah, that's one of the things that I'm doing in the long COVID clinic, is that we're collecting a lot of patient data to hopefully begin to then analyze and publish and begin to kind of explore what does long COVID actually look like and what are those neurological sequelae of COVID.
For sure. So a couple more, hopefully straightforward questions for you regarding POTS and ME/CFS. From what you've been describing, it really sounds like this is a diagnosis that's made clinically, correct? Not necessarily based on biomarkers or perhaps histology or anything like that, correct?
Correct. But I will say there's certainly autonomic testing you can do. So a tilt table test, which sounds just like what that is. I had it done on me. You put on a table, you're risen slowly upwards like Frankenstein. And, you know, you're hooked up to an EKG and so forth, and how your body responds is measured. There's also pseudomotor testing you could do. There's small fiber neuropathy related testing you can do that all can help support the diagnosis. But yeah, for the most part, it can be a clinical diagnosis. The criteria for POTS is, you know, a sustained increase in heart rate above like 30 to 40 beats a minute in an adult upon standing. Additionally, there's some lab work that you can, that is recommended that you can do, but typically they won't show anything, right? Because that's the first thing you want to do. You want to exclude more known issues, but typically, and as was in my case, perfect blood work, right? Like no inflammatory markers were elevated.
Healthy as a horse. No,
exactly. So it's like, what the heck's wrong with you? So certainly there is testing that can support the diagnosis, but for the most part, it's like, do you fit that clinical criteria?
Sure. And then regarding treatments, it sounds like it's probably primarily symptom management, not really curative, correct?
Correct. I think there's certainly a lot that can be explored in terms of how can you get your autonomic nervous system in check. Mm-hmm. So in my case, I've taken ivabradrine, which is an inhibitor of the funny current of the SA node. So it helps kind of control your heart rate without necessarily impacting the rest of your ANS.
Okay.
However, that drug is only indicated for heart failure, and therefore insurance companies do not like to pay for it if you have POTS. So it is very difficult for patients with POTS to get their hands on this one drug, who's been actually, it's actually been very well studied in POTS. Certainly there's more to study, but it has been very effective, and it was probably the best response that I had in terms of all the medications I've taken, because they're, for whatever reason, controlling the heart rate tends to also help with kind of all these other autonomic symptoms you might be having. But otherwise, right now I'm on propranolol, which helps tremendously controlling the heart rate, but then also just in general, I have felt a decrease in the frequency and severity of overall symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it's going to be mostly symptomatic. Lifestyle changes are key. So because hypovolemia tends to be an issue, supplementing with salt and electrolytes is critical. I have salt tabs. I take them frequently in anticipation of things that perhaps might dehydrate me. We tend to be very sensitive to the effects of things like alcohol, where which vasodilate. I like to say that I need to have McDonald's. I need the salt. McDonald's is actually healthy for me.
That's awesome. Not many people can say that.
I know, right? So I guess that's the only positive to come out of it. But then compression stockings, in some patients, abdominal binders help. But wanting to increase your intravascular blood volume and helping your body kind of shift that downward displacement of fluids back up to your brain, which sorely needs it.
Curious, because you're talking about all of these different treatments, it doesn't seem like it's going away completely. So I'm curious about how you addressed coming back from your medical leave, coming back into med school, again, this rigorous environment, especially having to do your clinical rotations, right? Where you perhaps have to be on your feet the whole day or have to be, you know, in a surgical operating room all day. So I'm curious how you overcame this hurdle of coming back into medical school.
Fantastic questions. It was hard with great effort. And transitioning to like clinical aspect of it, like to your point, like very first clerkship was my surgery clerkship.
Wow.
And this was the very first thing I like entered after essentially just being at home all the time, where I could very easily manage my symptoms. So to backtrack just a little bit, I think I am perhaps more unique in the degree to which I've been able to manage my symptoms. From what I hear and have spoken with other individuals with POTS and similar conditions, you don't really see very often improvement, or at least like really drastic improvement. Many individuals with POTS tend to be debilitated for quite a while. At the height of it for me, the orthostatic symptoms were so bad that I could not walk unassisted. That was also one of the reasons why I was just like, my body's not letting me continue. I literally could not walk in my own house without my wife carrying me around, supporting me. And
I mean, after her helping you like that, you had to marry her.
Exactly. She earned it, I guess. Funny story there, which I'll get back to, just in terms of like how, you know, we get used to the things. But yeah, you know, some individuals, they are wheelchair bound because of how afflicted they are. They sometimes benefit from service animals that can help with the frequent episodes of syncope. So there's this one study out of the Mayo Clinic that looked at just how debilitating POTS can be on things like your ADLs, and it was found to be as debilitating as having really bad COPD or congestive heart failure, right? So it's like not to underestimate how debilitating having all these symptoms can be. And like, surely, like, yeah, if you're an individual who can barely get through the day because of the cognitive fog, the fatigue, the pain, your inability to ambulate, to right? Like to just have basic access to what's around you. So I think just from my personal experience, it's been interesting the degree to which I have improved. Mm-hmm. I am certainly not, I'm not cured. It takes a tremendous amount of effort every day to make sure symptoms are in check. And if I forget to put on compression stockings, or if I forget to take my propranolol, or perhaps I had a little bit too much to drink, like, I will pay the price. So it takes a conscious effort every day to try to keep symptoms in check. And as I transitioned back to medical school from my leave, it was very difficult to figure those things out, and I still struggle with it. And that's also partially why it hasn't been a linear return to medical school. I haven't taken like full medical leaves, but I've taken smaller little breaks, or, you know, I've delayed many clerkships because I'll have flare-ups, or there's been so many consequences that I'm still dealing with that have prolonged my medical experience to now, to 2023, 2024. So it's certainly a daily challenge trying to manage it and stay on top of things, and perhaps maybe atypical, because again, from what I've seen, POTS can be a pretty serious debilitating condition.
Yeah. So what do you think was the biggest challenge that you faced getting back on track in terms of within the med school realm, right? You, of course, symptom management day to day is very difficult, but that's just a constant in your new normal, right? And so I'm curious, maybe there were specific things that you had to relearn, or just how you could comment on that.
It's a great question. I feel like it's difficult to answer because it was just like, it was a whole new experience. And it felt like, certainly now knowing what was wrong with me allowed me to better understand it, better advocate for myself. But it almost felt like I was starting from square one, almost as a new individual, if that kind of makes sense. Yeah. You know, I couldn't continue as things were. I had to face everything new and in the context of ensuring that I was managing my symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I do give a ton of credit to the school. I mean, honestly, like, Stritch has been great in supporting me and understanding kind of what's going on. Yeah. But I also do think that patient knowledge of what's going on with them is huge, because it allows them to advocate for themselves. Right. And I think I totally acknowledge that I'm in a uniquely privileged position to have a scientific background, medical knowledge, so that I can better understand what is wrong with me and advocate to other medical professionals and so forth. And certainly not everyone with POTS has that privilege, and it certainly leads to worse outcomes. But yeah, I mean, it feels like everything needed to be looked at differently and in the context of my new normal. Yeah,
for sure. And I mean, I give you a lot of credit for that, being the med school type. Probably it wasn't the easiest thing for you to, like you mentioned, having to continuously perhaps delay a clerkship based on however your body was acting. I think sometimes as medical students, we push ourselves. You certainly did your first couple of years, you know, ignoring the red flag, wanting to really like make sure you quote unquote stay on track. But I think that was probably a very difficult thing for you to personally overcome.
For sure. I've come up with this analogy over time where medical school is a marathon. However, I have had to run it with a backpack full of bricks.
I love that.
So without question, I'm not going to win this race. You know, like, right. I'm not going to end up first. I'll finish. I'll cross that finish line. I will. But I think it's very difficult for, the prototypical med school type to confront that reality that you are not going to be top of the pack.
Right.
That you are going to stumble several times, that you have to finish with this backpack full of bricks. But perhaps there is also something to say for one's tenacity, perseverance, and desire to finish no matter how heavy that backpack is.
I love that. I feel like that's great advice for anyone. You know, it leads me into my next question about what would you recommend to someone who may be in the position you are in, whether it be POTS or a different medical condition?
You know, I think first and foremost, you need the supports. And I think that's tricky, because sometimes when we're at our lowest, at our most afflicted, it is difficult to seek that support. Mm-hmm. I want to totally acknowledge that to begin with, that it isn't easy sometimes, even though we might know or want the help. But in those situations where you can, you know, rely on your friends, rely on your family members, advocate for yourself in front of, you know, your doctors and your school. And I am happy to say that I've had immense support from my family, my wife, my friends, such as Rasa asking if I need to go to the emergency room because I wasn't looking so good. But then all the other friends I've had throughout where, you know, we'd have a study room and I'd walk in and be like, I'm just going to lay on the floor.
And they're like, okay, it's just Nick being Nick.
And they know. That's exactly, literally. Let me just take off several layers and just lie on the floor. But then getting the help you need, be it the medical help, the psychiatric help, whatever it is, don't ever be ashamed of that, because there's no other way really forward if you haven't taken care of yourself first. And I get it. It's difficult to do. Sometimes we might not know how to. I totally acknowledge that. But I've benefited from having good support systems, and from the school to my doctors to my family and friends.
So is there anything you would like our listeners who are largely pre-medical and medical students to know about extending their medical education?
Yeah, certainly acknowledge that perhaps it won't always be the case that it's medical conditions that might be the impetus for delaying, but certainly it happened. Again, to go back to my analogy, it's difficult to grapple with the fact that you won't be at the front of the pack, that will have a heavy backpack on, but it's okay. And I think now at this point where I graduate in December, which is an atypical date to graduate, right? Like my whole medical course has been atypical, but I'm nearing the end of it. And as I look back, sure, it's been difficult to face each and every one of those, you know, stumbling points and having to push things or move things and delay things, but ultimately it feels like it's going to be okay. I'm still getting it done. I'm still going to cross that finish line.
And that's all that matters.
Yeah. You know, at the end, if you get there, and if you don't get there, that's fine too. Just take care of yourself.
Oh, I love that. Any parting words regarding POTS or ME/CFS that you want our listeners to know about?
For sure. The fact that we're seeing a greater incidence of it because of COVID, I'm seeing POTS come up more often on as you world questions. Mm-hmm. So I think certainly be aware of it. Again, some attitudes and degree of awareness that I've seen in the medical community is disappointing. It's lacking. So if anything, in addition to kind of sharing just a story of having to prolong your medical education, I do hope that the listener takes away some awareness of POTS, of dysautonomia, of ME/CFS, and that they can be serious conditions for individuals, life-changing. Please be the type of physician that takes a good history, that listens to your patient, that feels empowered to go and dive into the literature to educate yourself about topics you might not know, and perhaps just being aware of these conditions and seeing what you can do for your patients. Because, like, again, in my case, I feel like I was tremendously helped by just getting the diagnosis.
Yeah.
That alone was one of the biggest things for me, because it really opened the path forward to getting the appropriate treatment, mm-hmm. management, and connecting with a community that allowed me to feel validated in what I was feeling and going through, and understanding that there are ways forward. So just the mere identification of some of these conditions, even if there is no magic pill to cure it, can have a tremendously positive effect on your patients.
Well, thanks so much for joining me and chatting and really enlightening us about these two conditions that are very much under the radar still, but perhaps now popping up more and more with the pandemic. And thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing your whole story.
Thank you. And I'll leave you with a little comment about my wife and just kind of how we, over time, people just get used to things. How it went from, you know, me being on the ground and her freaking out to like, oh my God, I need to call an ambulance, to the point where it became so frequent that she just like she'd throw me a pillow and walk over me while I'm on the ground. My cat would come and just lie down. You know? So
I don't know whether to laugh or cry about that one.
I know. I'm doing a bit of both right now.
Well, thanks again. But, yeah. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support from our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate donations to help fund the production of this podcast. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can additionally find show notes, links, and information about our guests. We are at Medicus Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please submit them on our website. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relation is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views and opinions are their own and do not represent any organization.